And we are back. Black and a Half, episode number 246. I am Silas Lindenstein.
I'm Samantha Rund.
And this is longest running comedy podcast in Seattle. Probably. Now, today, we actually have a guest in today. We have director and world-renowned violinist, Lara St. John. I do apologize if I say the name incorrectly.
L-A-R-A. For our listeners, yes.
Yeah, I know. I have a problem with names. It's always funny. Samantha, every time I do soccer refereeing, I have to check kids in, and I just tell them, I'm going to say your name wrong. I'm going to say your name first name wrong. My name is Silas Lindenstein. I have my whole life, my name has been said wrong. So anyway, director St. John, they are on today for their documentary, Dear Lara. Got to say the name again. Dear Lara. Documentary, which deals with, essay abuse in the classical music world from when she was young, and then she examines it still going on, like within the world. It's actually this could be the musical version of the gymnast scandal that came out a few years ago, where it was discovered how long gymnasts had been being abused. Right?
It's hard it's a difficult and sensitive topic, and yeah, it is a little challenging having it on our comedy podcast.
Yeah,
and it's like an important thing to tell people about. So, I think I just preemptively say,
yeah,
this episode you all may experience us going a little bit from, yes, we're going addressing the serious to then kind of just jumping to comedian stuff a bit.
We talk about that. It's a feature.
Yeah.
I like to say it's a feature, not a bug in our programming, but we do deflect with comedy. Yeah. And after the interview, we do a bit of deflection. Saying straight during that, but we do. So trigger warning for anybody listening to the show that we do have an interview dealing with SA.
It didn't go into
not in depth
detail in it. So,
but it gets discussed a little bit about the issue of the problem within the classical music world. Mm-hmm. But we spend time talking about just interviewing her about. I mean, it's kind of like about the new to me, an awareness of the problem in the classical music. And what do you do when you have a kid who's showing talent and you want to put them in programs? And my fears, I've talked about my fears before on here of just not trusting anybody with my kids now. You know, we don't do sleepovers. We just don't do it. We have one couple that has kids that are friends with our kids that we will allow sleepovers at. But they're the only ones, and only because we have gone on vacation with them.
Oh,
like yeah. That's the only reason. Otherwise, there's no, our kids don't do sleepovers. Yeah. It's just not going to happen. Yeah. And then they need to know karate before they will ever be allowed before they're 18 to sleep over somewhere. They need to learn martial arts, maybe some knife skills.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway. Talk about the fears in there, Tears for Fears. And then we chat after the interview.
Learn a little bit too about the classical world as well, just in general, a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a new world. I was, you know, I will admit to all you folks listening, I too, after I had already booked this, and we did, this is the first guest in a long time, I did not ask the seven questions, the world famous seven questions, because it just didn't feel appropriate at the time. And it was right before the interview that I suddenly panicked and realized, I was like, this is a serious topic to be interviewing here. What do I do? And I just opted to not ask them and just focused on what they're there to promote. But the film this Dear Laura, it opens up premiering in the United States at the Santa Barbara Film Festival. So, and then it's going to premiere in Canada, Europe, England, all over the place. So this is kind of an early coup, I say, of an interview before it goes international. We were able to get an early interview before the world premiere. I think that's great. So this is just one of the signs that Black and a Half is going to take over the media. We're getting these early press dates, right?
That's right, Silas. Yeah.
That's what I say.
Yeah.
We got it there. And I think it's all because of our new theme music, really. I think it's.
Oh, my gosh. Sorry. I just was imagining our theme music with the interview. Hence my eyes going like, it's so hard not to make jokes about things when we're doing our podcast.
To be fair, I see other interview shows that have exciting music and then go into an interview.
Yeah. So, yeah. No. And I love our music. I
mean, yeah. So there. And our soon to be non AI generated podcast cover.
Oh, I was thinking of our outfits. That too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exciting.
Real faces. Our actual faces. Though I might keep it to help hide the wrinkles. I could just keep the AI generated. Dude, if you want to ever play with it, you can actually say, make me 10 years younger. Well, I've done it for losing weight. let me see a little. A little more muscle. How about if I had a little more muscle? Just wanted to see what it'll do, because it already is making me feel bad with all my gray hair. Anyway.
Alice, there's nothing wrong with gray hair.
I know.
You're talking to the wrong person, though. So, or the right person.
Yeah.
If you want to feel good about your gray hair, talk to me. If you want to feel bad about it, talk to somebody else.
Okay. Talk to my neighbors who make fun of it. All right. So here we are. Episode, please like, share, all the fun stuff. Listen, if you only get to listen to this sometimes on the podcast version, know there is a video version available on YouTube. Check it out, Black and a Half's channel on YouTube. Sit back, relax, open your hearts, open your ear holes, and listen to episode number 246.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to the longest running comedy podcast in Seattle, probably. Yes, this is Black and a Half, hosted by Silas Lindenstein and Samantha Rund. Black and a Half.
Now we're our show's Black and a Half, and usually it's we tend to talk about a lot of comedic things, but we also talk about creativity, and we're both parents. And one of the things that intrigued me about this was Samantha played cello. I hope I'm not outing you with the
no,
cello.
No, actually, I was very intrigued and moved by the story. And also I was like, oh, You're a genius, because I've played violin growing up.
Oh, wow.
And then I was not to the level that you were by any means. And then I played cello a little bit, and I'd like to get back into both of them, but I have such a love of like stringed instruments. So,
great. I mean, that's what I always tell folks, like, even if you know a little bit about it and play a little bit, I mean, that's enough to sort of help your appreciation of music. You know, you don't have to be at this huge high level. Yeah, like you can have fun skating. You don't have to be able to do a triple axel.
Yeah.
Right. I know. Right, you know? Exactly. Yeah.
What I also like, I coach soccer. Mm. And one of the things I keep talking, you know, there's been some recently in Washington out here, there was a sexual abuse thing. A coach was discovered. And I've said to friends, like, I don't know where my kids are safe to go to between, yeah. You know, I mean, we've had everyone knew about Hollywood kind of anyway, but with the gymnast scandal that came out, that everyone, again, it feels like things are just becoming more mainstream aware. But
Boy Scouts too.
Recently. Boy Scouts. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I'm just like,
It never occurred to me classical music.
Yeah, I know. It
Like
never
as a,
occurred I
I was like,
either. It
and I'm,
yeah.
well, that's the opening line of the film. You know, everybody's like, "Oh, it's so beautiful. Everything's always fine." It's like, no, there is an underbelly, and I think it just has to do with when, you know, in our profession at least, these always men are given inordinate amounts of power. Like almost like messianic power. And it's not, you know, there's problems like this in every field, but you don't have like, you know, 14-year-old accountants or, you know, 8-year-old physicists or whatever, you know. So they do tend to be, you know, more in the fields that where people have to start very, very young. So you did see it in gymnasts, in you know, the Catholic Church, the Boy Scouts, you know, you have these adults who are given this power. And obviously, there are a hell of a lot of violin and piano teachers who are very decent, great musicians and stuff, but somehow it does seem to attract these men who get off on using that power. And unfortunately for us, as you saw in the film, the institutions are very complicit and they want to keep those famous men there. And that's what I wanted to bring to the world, is that, you know, we have to stop this. And in order to stop this, we need to stop the complicity.
And is that just, do you think that that's just talking about it? So the it, to stop the like I was because I'm like, well, what can I do? Like, part of me is just like, well, my kids are just not going to take any classes on anything. I just want to put them in a bubble.
Yeah, well, that's not really a solution. Sure. Well, what I'm hoping to do with some various partners and eventually is to have something called kind of the gold standard, so that, you know, you'll put your school through these ideas, and if they pass the gold standard, then you know that it's a safe place to send your kid. Like a lot of these schools, like I said in the movie, like they're like, oh, we'll just put in some windows and everything will be fine, you know. And then they continue to let the professors teach off campus and things like that. So no, everything is not fine. You know, there have to be a lot of absolute rules when it comes to children. And honestly, I consider children to about age 24. Because, you know, your brain's still very malleable, and it can easily be damaged at that point also. So I'm also talking about colleges and not just students who are children. But yeah, it just they seem to think that these little band-aids will do something, but it's actually the whole hierarchy which is built on protecting the famous man and considering the women, the children, the students to just be expendable.
Do you think it's getting? Oh, how many years ago was this? Did you finish this, or was this?
The documentary?
Yeah, that actual filming.
Well, I guess like last year now, because it's January, but
Yeah.
yeah, I mean I think we got final cut in something like August or September. So it's been it's not out there yet, you know, and what I'm hoping is that it'll be like a little snowball that creates an avalanche. Like it'll really get people talking and saying, why is this happening? Why does this keep happening? Lara says it's still happening. Yes, I do, because people talk to me. And you know, and we need to get people to say this is not acceptable.
Yeah, it's like so important to get that story out there, and for people's assumptions as well. Because I'm just thinking, you know, when I went out to LA or, you know, doing things in the acting world, I was prepared to know, like, hey, look over your shoulder, or just like, don't trust such and such. Like, these kinds of things happen here. Fortunately, that didn't happen to me, right? But I did have a couple of odd propositions, though, Silas. I don't know if I ever told you about those, which is funny because they were more in comedy, which I was
Oh,
not
yeah.
expecting. That was something I just, because I was new to comedy, and so I hadn't been prepared for that. I didn't have that story. So I could see, you know, how important it is to let people know, hey, this happens in this world where you think you're going to be ultra protected, and where it's like seems to be very you know,
Right.
good feelings and highbrow and clean, or just, you know, just lovely, that most people don't even think that. They don't even know to look out for it.
Well, and maybe something happened to you in comedy because you weren't expecting it, and therefore you were at a more vulnerable, you know, I think these people can really feel, they have like a sixth sense for who the vulnerable ones are. All of these, I call them predators. And yeah, I mean, there's been whisper campaigns in music schools for years, you know, oh, don't take lessons with him. Don't, you know, be careful. Don't be in a car alone with this guy. Why should there have to be that? You know, that really just has to end. You got to get rid of the cancer and not the symptom. You know, it doesn't make any sense. And I don't know. I hope this will really bring that home to a lot of people in my profession. And I'm also hoping that because I'm relatively, well, it's a small profession. So, I mean, within that, I'm relatively well-known. And this is the first time somebody who is kind of well-known within the profession who's saying, geez, man, you got to stop this. And from their own experience as well. So hopefully people will listen this time.
It's, I think there's part of me that wanted this to like, it's hard to believe at 2026. I'm like, there's a 78-year-old man
Is
who
it
has
hard
not.
To believe? Do you
I don't
see
know.
What's going on in the news?
It's hard
I'm
for me
sorry,
to believe.
Silas.
I know. I think it's the same problem with like
so loud.
With like comedy, where it tends to be people, you know, in comedy, people tend to be a little more forward thinking, or they're open to ideas because they've talked about stuff. Generally, I think a bunch. I know there's not. But then I think of the arts and I think of classical music is so like, and I'm just like, how people in the arts feel like they usually hear about things and start identifying problematic behavior earlier. And I mean, that maybe that was just a gross assumption on my part early on by bad influence of a bunch of liberal-minded folks that I first went to school with, thinking like, oh, well, everyone's progressive here. And then to, I don't know, I'm just baffled. It's 78. I'm like, I'm just starting to think when, like, how do you not, how did they get this old without seeing other scandals and going, oh yeah, that would be bad. That's me. Oh, I'm doing something wrong. I better stop now.
Because like, they thought it was that it was deserved. It was like a perk of the job or something, like a parking space or something. You know, I mean, I don't think these people really thought they were doing anything wrong. It was just like, oh, you know, well, this is a student, so I can do anything I want with this person. And I mean, these people are really evil. And also, if you think about it, you know, comedy, it's all about what's happening today, or it usually is. And our profession, it's basically playing the music of dead white men.
Yeah.
And old white men. And only now are we seeing, you know, in the real sort of thought-provoking areas of classical music, which is basically composition, you know, conducting, those are still sort of 5 to 10% women, you know, and because of that, and you as you probably saw in Catherine Needleman's mosaic bit in the film, all of the people in positions of power, nearly all in all of the American symphonies are still American and Canadian, are still they're men. You know, so you might have 30 violinists who are women, but they're all in the second violin section. The concertmaster is a man. You know, so this keeps happening where, you know, oh, it's okay, we have women here, so it's just fine. But they're actually in subordinate positions always. And so it's not just fine, you know. And so she's basically spent the past 6, 7 years pointing that out. And I'm sort of on the other side of it. She's more about the orchestral side. I'm more about the educational side because of, you know, the respective things that happen to us. But yeah, it, I think it's because we're in a past century, basically, in various past centuries. And those composers, I mean, Beethoven is a god to everybody at these schools. And so therefore the man who teaches you about Beethoven is also a god, and you must do everything that man says. That's the general feel.
Yeah. So what would you tell a parent, like their kids, like, oh, has a little gifted in one of these instruments, and they're looking at schools or something to progress the child. What kind of warning would you give them as far as, there's part of me that's like, oh, I don't even want to trust somebody saying that they're really good. What if their ulterior motives are going to get them in there? Like, what would you,
That has happened. Yep.
oh God. What would you like? So how, what did the parents look out for? Would you just say like, be present all the time? Don't let that.
Well, certainly as a child, I think the parent should probably be present all the time. Yeah. And if you're taking your kid to a lesson with one pretty easy way around that is now that there are so many women in music, just get a really fantastic woman teacher. Because of the hundreds and hundreds of people who have reached out to me, not one have had anything to say about a woman predator. There's never been one. So that's one way of doing it. The other is just to really, inform yourself about, I mean, if you're talking about colleges or something, just be informed about what are their procedures, what are the walls they have in place to make sure that that doesn't happen. Do they have windows in the studios? I mean, just little things like that are really, really super important. And you should say, go watch Laura's movie. Well, it is it tells you things.
How is it hard? It's not a fun, like the topic isn't like delightful. How do you go through press days just and even just editing? Like, is it hard to relive this over and over? Or
Well, it's hard to it was it's been hard to have so many stories told to me. I mean, it just every single one, I think, oh, this could have been avoided. Oh, if only. Oh, if, and it does sort of bring one down a little bit. You have to learn to compartmentalize a bit, obviously. And I think that in the end, and I have my ups and downs. At one point, I had to take 10 months completely away from the subject and the film. And it was partly because of COVID as well. I felt like the world was ending. And I was like, wow. I think we were all kind of like
that'll
that.
knock them out.
I don't know. It just it somehow the sort of vision of basically next week, the Santa Barbara premiere. I mean, thank God on for Santa Barbara to be taking a chance on a first time director and giving us this world premiere. And like just that's just been in my sights the whole time. Like even if I can hardly get up in the morning because I just heard another story or I just did this, it's like, come on, we got to get this out there. We got to get this out there. We've got to clean this up. And you're at the vanguard and you're the one who can do it. You have to speak for all these people. And so that's just been getting me up every morning and then keeping me going throughout the past 6 years, I guess.
There was a mention, I'm trying to remember if it was you or one of somebody you're interviewing about not having trouble finding joy in music.
I think it was Zenobia, probably. She was like, she was talking about, she was in the Nashville Symphony, and she was talking about how just so much of this kind of coming down on one's head kind of takes away the love of music, which is why we're supposed to be there in the first place. And that has definitely happened to a lot of people that reached out to me. I'd say over half of them no longer play their instrument, if something bad happened to them, and then even more don't even listen to music. So they've completely lost that joy. It's been ruined for them. And that makes me like, that's what sort of keeps me up at night and keeps me from getting out of bed. It's just like not only the joy that's been lost, but like the brain drain. I mean, the talent that left the field, like the women who are abused out of the field. And people ask, like, well, where are the women? How come there's no, women concertmasters and this and that? It's like, well, like think of that road that they have to go upon, which is so much more difficult than it is for men. And I won't even get into the, there's obviously I'm a particularly pasty version of white here, but it's classical music is also a big problem when it comes to race. And there's a few organizations that are really doing a lot for that. I support the Sphinx a lot. They're based in Detroit, and they're kind of a competition and a whole sort of family of folks who really encourage Black and Latino classical, especially string players. And they give out scholarships, and they do so much. I mean, I've judged their competition a couple of times, and in the past 20 years, they've made a huge difference. But there's still pushback on, on all that kind of stuff from well, basically, you've got these men who've been allowed to do whatever they want for the past hundreds of years, and all of a sudden people are saying, "Now wait a second, also we can do that, and hey, maybe we can like do it better." And and of course they're going to push back and say, "Oh no, well it's all about quality and only white men can do it," or kind of like the Vienna Phil and all these places that only a few years ago even allowed one woman into their orchestra. And like, it's glacial. The pace at which this is improving.
And it's so wild to me that just that train of thought, it's like I don't understand how people could, like you came out of a woman in some fashion. You exist because of a woman. How can you hate women so much? Like, how can you think that they're so lesser?
It's just this disdain. Well, somebody once pointed out this Israeli conductor actually. She said, for example, in those big parts of classical music, like conducting, like composition, and you have basically, to be really kind about it, maybe 8% women. And now that we know that talent in music is gender equal, I mean, it's not shot putting, for God's sakes, And now that we know that, that means actually that a good 40% of those men are not really. They're probably quite mediocre. And so they have a real vested interest in like keeping women down in order to keep their jobs. And so that's what we see over and over and over again is the exclusion of women, and that leads to harassment and abuse every time.
I always wonder if that is conscious, like, or if it's like this flight or fight response. Like, is there something in their lizard brain trying to keep women out that they're not aware of? Because I'm like, I have a hard time wrapping around the idea of somebody going, "Well, I got to keep the women out." Like, is this? I know what's happening, and I'm
It
just curious if it's conscious or.
might be a subconscious bias as well. I mean, it might just be something that is driven into people. I mean, like I said, almost all of the pieces played by orchestras are by, dead white men. There's like no women. And so those are the gods, and those are the people you must follow. And therefore, women aren't part of this, and well, they weren't allowed to be, obviously, for you. But there's actually more and more. There's these initiatives, the Boulanger Initiative, for one that has actually started publishing works that were not published by women because they weren't allowed to be published. They weren't allowed to, but they did write. A lot of women wrote in the Romantic and even the Baroque period, and so they're starting to find all of those manuscripts and bring them back to light again. Yes.
I played violin is also like was the first instrument I ever tried to play.
Oh, great.
I've talked about it before, but I was tricked because I was told I was taking fiddle lessons because I saw fiddle was cool. It wasn't actually until about a year ago I realized, wait, that was a violin. I didn't realize.
Well, they're the same thing. I mean, it's just a different kind of music, and
But I was
there's.
playing Mary Had a Little Lamb. I'm sure that's probably taught in both classes.
I think it's probably, yeah, that's like a by fiddles and piece.
But you started at 2 years old?
Well, two and a half to be really
Oh,
exact.
okay. You were okay. Not that gift.
Well, I mean, the violin was a lot smaller,
That's
obviously.
also incredible. Like, you didn't break it. Like, it's hard to imagine a 2-year-old having a violin and not just immediately like smashing it.
Huh.
Well,
Because I don't
our
give.
2 year-olds.
Right? I mean, mine wouldn't, she wouldn't do it on purpose, but it's just, well, maybe. She's 4 now. But I mean, just giving a 2-year-old something so delicate, it's.
They're not, it's not a Stradivarius when you're 2 years old. I think I started like on a 32nd size fiddle. I mean, it can't possibly have sounded good. And, they only cost, they're factory made somewhere. They only cost like $100. So if somebody does throw it up in the air, it's not really the end of the world, I suppose. But yeah, it, you know, you grow with the violin. And then finally, I think I was about 12 or 13. I mean, I'm a pretty big, long person. So I had my first full size at 13.
Did you love it? Do you remember loving it since you were a kid? Like that, was it you that wanted to do it?
I loved the music. I loved playing the music, but I didn't understand the scales. I thought they were just punishment and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I think it was around that time, around 12, 13, that I finally sort of thought, okay, you know, maybe this is what I want to do. Yeah, you know, but that's kind of weird. Okay, you're 13 and you think this is what I want to do. That's early for most people, but it's also 9 years after I started it, right?
Right.
So the whole thing is kind of just really weird in a way. It's just, it's a very strange life.
Because I got my kids to start piano when they were 5.
Great.
And so they've been playing. So one of them is now 10.
Okay.
So I don't know how long I don't talk about it really, as far as like, oh, it's just something we do each week once, you know, and you practice. I don't know when I let her decide, like, and let her know that there's options about, she started playing guitar a little bit too, which I've been very much, you don't need to do lessons. That's fine. That's
yep.
As you don't want. But I've been kind of been like, well, you need to do piano so you know how to do whatever you want to do later.
Yeah.
No,
it's a great idea, because piano is the one that really, it's so useful for so many things. I mean, I would kill to play piano. I can't play piano at all. I'm a real one trick pony over here. But you know, also guitar. That's one where so many amazing guitarists are self taught.
And yeah.
But with the skills of the piano and the ideas of, you know, the notes and where they are and the visual, she'll probably be able to pick it up like 2 or 3 times as fast than if you hadn't given her those piano lessons.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm all for it. And I'm not saying she should like go to school and piano and college and do competitions or anything. No, not at all.
No, but now I want her self-taught, basically.
No, but I think it's really great. Like I was saying to Samantha, you know, even just that little knowledge of picking up and trying to, then it gives you insight into music and how it is, how it's made, and what it can do for, you know, well, the soul, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah.
What it's made for, right?
Mm-hmm.
For the soul. I think looking at our time here, I think I'm about out of time.
Oh, I babbled. Sorry.
There's
no babbling.
Fantastic.
There
was babbling. God, our show. That's our show. But thank you so much for coming on with us.
Thank you. Yeah. Today.
This has been great. You premiere at Santa Barbara.
On February 6th at 5:20.
Okay.
And then we have a sophomore. I coined that. Hope you like it. It's February 8th at 3 p.m.
Okay.
So if you are a big football fan, you'll probably want to come to one of the other ones.
Yeah,
but but I'm thinking, you know, there's a Venn diagram somewhere. It's like people who want to see Dear Laura and people who want to watch the Super Bowl, and they don't meet.
Yeah. I'm sure they'll we'll get some of them over on the other
well,
side.
Well, I'm looking for, I want to see that halftime actually. So I'm hoping.
Yeah.
That's right. What I'm really interested in.
Oh yeah, good point. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Sure. And then is there plan right now, we're just releasing it on there and then looking at video on demand later, I imagine at some
Yeah, point. That's all sort of kind of still up in the air because everything is sort of going towards the world premiere as it always does. And that'll be Santa Barbara. And then, you know, there'll be obviously a Canadian premiere, European, probably UK and this and that. And then, yeah, I mean, obviously I want it to get out to the broadest audience possible. So streaming would probably be the answer at this point. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad that we were able to get you early on in the premiere status of this and get to meet you. So we look forward. Best of luck at the premiere.
Thank you.
And with the film in general.
Thank you. It's my first premiere. I mean, I've seen a film at a festival once in a while, but this is my first time on a red carpet. So it's all very exciting.
Very exciting. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And that was it. That was our interview with Laura St. James. from the documentary director of the documentary, Dear Laura. I guess from, because she's in it a little, but like, did you know that originally I was going to try to be a documentary filmmaker?
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Originally, like the very first thing you remember ever wanting to do?
No, that was Jedi. But the second, when I was like in high school and I was starting to think about doing like, making movies or something, my dad was like, you should do documentaries because you'll get grants to do a documentary. And then you use the grant money to buy the film equipment to go shoot it. And that's just what you do. You just write a grant and you get money and you go do it. And I was like, that sounds like a good idea. That's how impressionable I was as a kid. I was ready to be a documentary filmmaker because my dad said you should do this.
Well,
and I was like, he had an idea.
It's for you, right?
He also made it sound so easy.
I mean,
just get a grant.
Yeah. Well, now you have your phone there. You do it with your phone.
What? Record the grant or record the documentary?
Yeah, record a grant too. Yeah. I do think it'd be really awesome to do a documentary. I'm going to go on a tangent because that made me think of one of the things that I want to do. I always want to do these studies. I want to do kind of like almost like a psychological study or something, or a social. Oh, why am I messing up this word?
Sociological.
Yeah. Like just, you know, something, I suppose it's still in the acting realm of like just human behavior. Uh-huh. Like I always want to do these studies and just ask people questions and get like a ton of data and then compile the data. And I will admit that sometimes it's because I want to prove my hypotheses correct for something. Like I think X, Y, and Z. This is an intuitive feeling I have. I would like to study, get enough data, and then I could like, I forgot about that. It's something I...
That you...
Things that I
would
love.
Wait, which part did you forget about?
Just that this was a whole thing that I wanted to do.
Studies?
When you were talking about your dream of being a documentary
maker. I could see you as a researcher.
Yeah.
I could have seen that. That seems very you.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like the other half or whatever.
That's the real dream job.
Well, I guess it's a mix. Like, because I thought it'd be great to be a psychologist or actually a couples counselor, like a relationship or mediator.
I am a couple counselor. I've got advice for couples. Let me tell you.
Well, I mean, it's not necessarily, it doesn't have to be romantic. I think I just like seeing things from different like people and their different points of views and then helping them like have peace. Or helping them figure out like, hey, we can figure this out together, or you go here and I go there.
So you have the idea of being a counselor, a couple's counselor for non-romantic relationships.
No, it could be romantic, but it doesn't have to, because you know, sometimes there's stuff with like siblings that are having issues or best friends or coworkers or blah blah blah. It doesn't always have to be just people who are in a relationship who could use a little
counseling. Okay, but is there counseling for like is there couple counseling for siblings?
Well, it's probably not called couples counseling. It's probably like relationship counseling, you know?
I don't know though. It is relationship counseling. You're right.
I know some people have gone to like, I heard this from a friend. It was after their father had passed and they did like a big, huge family counseling session, with all the other siblings and this and that. I don't know, Silas. I have a
family family counseling.
I would have been in school for a million years. You know, it's like, so I suppose that's where one of my research ideas came from, because it's like, well, I could go back to school or I could just independently do research. And then none of those things happened and we podcasted. So
that's the exact order it went. I have to Google this. I need to know. I've realized there is relationship counselors or family counselors.
Yeah.
Family therapy, conflict resolution. Oh, conflict mediation. I just have a hard time. I feel like that would be hard to get someone to do.
Oh yeah.
Like conflict, like co-collaborators, like us. If we were having like issues about getting this stuff done. Right. No, but if we were because that sometimes can happen with your podcast partner, Manny. Hey, can we go see a mediator? Because I got to talk. We need to talk about. I'd be like, a mediator?
And now I want a Saturday Night Live sketch. Now I want it because I also wanted to do these ridiculous infomercials. Ridiculous. We're so off topic. I'm so off topic. Ridiculous version of, training videos, corporate training videos.
Yeah.
I wanted to make ridiculous versions of that. Anyway, but when you were saying how nobody wants to go to a mediator, it made me think of what a hilarious Saturday Night Live sketch that would be of like, but you didn't see this mediator. And it's, Martello Hernandez or what is his name? I forget. Like, I don't know. I could just see
the
possibilities of these characters, or better yet, us, right? So that we could, sketches.
Look, Samantha, I think we need a laugh after this interview because, folks, I mean, you've come in. If you're this far, you already listened to the interview, right? It is a hard topic, right? Sexual. I don't want to get edited by Facebook or whatever. Not that that's his on Facebook. It doesn't matter. Yeah. S-A?
That's for sure.
S-A.
Right. Although,
especially of minors, right? It's a hard topic, but I watched what's funny is I was just I'm doing a practice rewatch and we just got through one of these. It wasn't a music teacher, but it was something a kid was going through. It's actually, I believe, the thing that gets the lead character out of the off the show. Bobby leaves, it's a case about an SA minor that he has to.
Thanks for ruining the practice for me. I've never seen it.
Wait, I thought you said you haven't seen it in a long time.
Is it Dylan? Is it the blue-eyed guy with the black hair? Is he in the? Is that the one? I was getting confused. I was thinking The Good Wife when you said that, and then I was
practice. Dylan McDermott. Yeah, Dylan McDermott. That's who
it is, right? I don't know that I've seen it, but I just remember like some of the advertisements.
Which amazes me. I can't
see it because you ruined it for me. Ugh.
It had some Dylan McDermott. It's funny. He's the lead, but I don't think he was the strongest actor on the show. He was just beautiful. He's a beautiful man. But the guy who played Eugene Young, who I guess he was.
I just imagined Eugene Levy, and it was really funny to take this seriously while imagining him.
No, the who is this guy? Because his name is Steve Harris. He apparently was in someone told me he was in a movie that made a lot of people like don't like him because of his character. He was so good as his character in some movie that people like, because I was like, how come this guy's not booked all the time? Because he was great. I was like thinking, maybe do you just get rich from this role and so he doesn't need to? But let's see, Steve Harris, what was it? He was in something. Oh, Diary of a Mad Black Woman. He's in that. He plays Charles McCarter. Like, apparently, I haven't seen that movie, but apparently he's so good in it. People hate him because of them. Like, isn't that like a weird thing? Like, you're so good. People are like, they think you're the character now.
Yeah.
They don't want to. I don't want to see that guy. I don't like him. What he did. That was an actor. He was just really good.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like the best. I was watching the practice was on when I was in school, theater school. So we would talk about like, he's the best eye actor. So much goes on as his eyes in these moments. It was so good. I had to look everybody up because I was like, I don't see any of these actors anymore.
What is your shirt though? There's no place like 127001.
It's a nerd shirt because if you set up a network at home, that's the address of home.
Oh, that's awesome.
So it says there's no place like home.
That's really. I love that.
But in nerd speak, it's one of my real estate shirts that I got. Oh, now, so
I'm I can't be jealous, but I'm.
It's not an original joke.
I'm not
it's
like no, I love it. You know, it's funny because I was actually looking last night. I was looking for real estate shirts. I actually was, but I didn't find any that I was like, I felt like I would actually want to wear. There were a lot that was like, this girl does real estate. Like,
oh, yeah. There's a lot
of
that.
Do that playing a character, but not.
Yeah. Around. That's that. I have found the similar hard thing. That's why I bought. That's one of the reasons I have a heat press so that I can print my own shirts.
Oh.
So if you need a shirt, if you have a design, I can get it printed for you if you want.
Yeah, but that's cool. Oh, let's make our shirts for Black.
I want to. Yeah, we should if we want to come. Yeah, get our AI generated faces
let's
on them.
That's right. Let's do it. And cool. Thanks. I will think I would love that.
Yeah.
Both of those things. Maybe, I don't know about the generation. But
anyway.
On top. Yes. Yeah.
It's a hard topic that we don't usually, because we're the longest running comedy podcast in Seattle, probably. We don't, as our theme music says.
Like, you don't really want to like laugh during or after that. That's kind of, laughing after it because it's.
Which is funny because I remember such hard laughs in plays where like, it's why you need a comic moment to defuse the emotion a lot.
Yeah.
Not because we don't write Greek tragedies anymore where you just cry the whole time.
Well, it's like, why do you think Black and Jewish people are so funny?
Yeah, we have to go. We've been through a lot.
You have to laugh.
Yeah. Have you, let me ask you this. Have you ever found that to be challenging with, I won't even say romantic relationships, non-romantic relationships. Have you found it in your life relationships? Has it been difficult with people who aren't comedians to understand the need to like make a joke about something to relieve the tension? Like,
well, it depends, but I sometimes stumble upon something. You know how I love doing callbacks? And
yes.
I actually had a thing the other day with somebody who said something and they laughed and I thought it was hilarious. They laughed and then I thought it was hilarious. And then we talked a little bit more. And then I kind of called that back, but their mood had shifted. And then they got upset and they said that I was being rude. And I was like, but that was funny. And I didn't get that it was funny. I'm like trying to explain why it was funny. But then that just made them feel more upset and more like I was not.
Were they a non-comedy comedian?
Yes, they were not a comedian. You know, and then I apologized, you know, because I'm like, listen, I said that because I thought you were going to laugh again. You know, you'd be like, oh, clever. You thought of it again. I thought you would laugh more, but that did not have the desired effect. I will not say that next time. I am sorry.
Do you think that we compartmentalize more than the average person?
Like you, Silas, and me, Samantha?
Like, yes, us, but as being comedians / actors, do you think that we, to do the tasks, particularly because some of the content is like this interview topic or whatever, sometimes it can be, do you think we have to compartmentalize than the average normal person?
Well, I think the other thing too is we're also mixed. And I think that actually, for me, that might have a...
That makes you compartmentalize or...
Actually, shall we define compartmentalize? I'm going to...
I guess...
Make sure that I'm thinking of it in the same fashion you are, because I'm thinking.
Well, let me guess on the, you know what? My daughter does this to me all the time. She goes, hey, what's that mean? And I'm like, that, oh, man, you know what? Okay, how do I define this now properly? Because without messing up her education, I think of it, compartmentalize is like this topic. I can be in, completely talk about this topic. And then. Without it affecting the other topic.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Like separating, dividing into sections or categories. So I suppose it could be like, hey, this goes into this compartment and let me go over here to this other. I think with some things, let's see. I think it depends for me, whether or not I can compartmentalize and how well I compartmentalize and if I'm asking myself to compartmentalize and how aware I am, if I'm compartmentalizing, but the being mixed thing, I would say for me, where does it rank in my compartmentalizing abilities or
I don't understand how you compartmentalize being mixed.
I would think for me, when I think of when I compartmentalize things, it's almost like a magic trick where it's like, abracadabra, I don't think of this anymore, or I'm just operating right here, right now, you know?
And yeah.
Then for me, sometimes that's come from, you know, just like I'm the only brown person in this room right now, and I don't want to feel uncomfortable. Abracadabra, I'm not worrying about it anymore. Or I think they said something okay. racist, but they might not actually be racist. I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt. Abracadabra, let me just like, you know, so that, and like, I don't think I really do like much code switching, but I know, you know, a lot of people, they do more code switching.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that could play into okay. that mentalizing. And then in terms of the actor thing, yeah, a bit by, you know, now you're going into this reality and those are your circumstances that you're pretending with. And then you have to shake that off so you don't turn into a crazy person. You just kind of,
yeah.
But I think partially to the way that I was trained as an actor, and part of what I lean into as an actor is very much based on my five senses. That it's not so much, it's not as much of compartmentalizing, because it's not just like all in my head, but it is a sort of like we're stepping in and we're stepping out. So
mm-hmm.
Maybe, I don't know.
Well, makes sense. I get you. I hear that.
Yeah. I suppose when the jokes, you know, when it was a joke that was supposed to land and instead you cry or you end up not, then you probably were not in the right place. You were you maybe shouldn't have been compartmentalizing into comedian zone then. I don't know.
I mean, these predators also probably compartmentalize it, right? Because like I've looked at, I was watching the morning show, you know, the morning show, the Apple TV show, the morning show, where the lead character in the first season, one of the leads, is played by Steve Carell. He is basically the Matt Lauer, right? You remember Matt Lauer from the Today Show, who found out he had like a button at his door on his desk that would shut the door, that would lock the door and stuff.
No.
So he got kicked out after the huge sexual essay allegations.
Oh, geez.
Well, and essay stuff that he did, oh. Right? But, and he was just known. Everyone knew he's a nice guy, Matt Lauer. Well, it's just Matt Lauer, just such a great guy, who reported on the Hollywood essay scandals, right? And would do all this and talk about, well, this is horrible, what's going on. But they compartmentalized what they did versus what the Weinsteins did, right? They could separate it completely.
Well, then I don't even want to say that I compartmentalize.
Well, but everybody does, right?
I know. Like, everyone does. Amount, and then when is it healthy and
but
not?
But they don't. Some people just cannot understand the difference between their own actions and someone else doing the same action.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I see what you're saying, like the hypocrisy.
Yeah.
But I also wonder, is it true that they couldn't see the difference, or they just didn't care? Because, I mean, we don't know the kind of mask somebody is wearing.
I mean, that's true.
And when somebody is lying to themselves, like, how much are they lying to themselves? And, like, is somebody, if when somebody is lying to themselves, are they aware of it? Is it a subconscious thing? Like, there's nothing like having somebody you love lie to your face that might F up with your mind on that. But I do question that, because I do think there's levels of lying and levels of manipulation.
So what about, I mean, this is not the same, how you have people who will say, people who receive welfare being against other people getting welfare because, well, I need it. They're abusing it. Because they assume other people would abuse it, but they themselves
Well, oh, no. That, I feel like that's a broad category, though. Cause, you know, I think, like, maybe if we just... How could I make that... Like, if Sally says that about James, and Sally's situation is different than James, then it's not necessarily hypocritical. But if they have the same...
But they're the same. Like, no, I'm saying one that, like, it's kind of the same, but they think the other person's different just because it's not them.
If it's exactly the same situation, then that doesn't make sense to me.
But it makes sense to them. Compartmentalizing?
Have you ever heard somebody with the exact same situation say that? Like, well, the
pretty
exact
close. Same situation? I mean,
give me a situation.
Every Republican in Minnesota or not, Missouri, like, they do complain about the... You see people committing fraud, complaining about fraud, but they earnestly think they've done nothing wrong.
Oh boy.
I believe a Donald Trump thinks that he did nothing wrong, even though he did exactly the same thing as someone else.
Well, he,
who they're saying that was wrong.
I think it could be one of two things. He legitimately doesn't think he did anything wrong because he sees those situations as different. Or he's lying, and that he knows he did something wrong. He doesn't care, but he will still say that he didn't do anything wrong because you can't say you did something wrong. I think somebody could do something similar, but see it, they have created some difference in their mind that they don't see it as being the exact same thing.
Do you think that's what most people do when they're doing wrongs that we all know are wrong, that they think that they are, well, it's different for me? If people understood the situation, they'd see that this isn't as wrong.
That's where I feel like it's so nuanced, because I feel like sometimes there really is a difference. It could be minute, but there is some difference that they're clinging on to. And sometimes that could just be the cover up of their own guilt, of then they're lying to themselves because they don't want to feel guilt, or they could be a sociopath or something. You know, I feel like there's...
But I mean, these Catholic priests, right, that did stuff, they have to know it. They know it's wrong. Like, this, what I don't get from this documentary.
Oh yeah. I totally, mind went so far away from the documentary.
Right. No, but even like people, I thought the Matt Lauer thing, because it was closest to this kind of thing where they're reporting on it, but I don't know, like, but think that they're different. These 78-year-old men committing this, I'm like, how do they not? They know it's wrong, right? They know it's wrong. They have to know it's wrong.
Honestly, I don't know what people think, because people's minds yes, first and foremost, obviously it's wrong. It's wrong and it's horrible. Whether or not they know, they actually believe that it's wrong.
Do you think they think everyone else is wrong? And that it's not wrong?
I mean, I don't know. I don't know. You know, because I've watched, you know, certain I found documentaries with cult leaders to be quite interesting. Like, I've watched several documentaries about cults or cult leaders and this and that. And seeing the things that people do and or believe because they've been so brainwashed into it. And then as an actor myself, thinking, like, how would I play this person? Well, I don't know the psychology behind it.
Yeah.
The lies and or the weird belief systems have to where my judgments, reality judgments, they would have different judgments based on their beliefs. But I do question it, because some of those people at the top who are saying this stuff, it's like, well, they have to know. They have to know. But I also don't know, because of how twisted their minds are, like how twisted their reality is
to be able to even justify in their own head. Yeah, what they're
how
doing.
Twisted their reality is to even be able to do something like that. I am also I know I'm probably compartmentalizing a bit since that was the word today, the word of the day, because it's too horrifying to think about
yeah. some
of the things that people do. Their moral compass is completely different. But I think that realistically, like that one book that says the body keeps the score.
Mm.
It's like, yeah, and so does the soul, and they're going to pay for it. Like in this life or the next,
the soul,
everybody pays for things. I don't think that's the title of a book. I just made one up. Like the body
keeps it should
the
score. Be.
The Body Keeps the Score is an actual book.
That's a good title, though.
The Body Keeps the Score is an actual book, and so does the Soul. That's my tag on. No, The Body Keeps the Score is written by, I think, Bessel van den Kirk. I don't know if I said his name right, but he's one of the leading trauma experts in the world or something. Okay. But I was just reading this for light reading years before I needed to. I was just reading it. It was fascinating, but our bodies hold on to different pieces of trauma or tension or memory and things like that. And it's a very interesting, fascinating read.
And that's where the comedian comes in and they go, oh, is that where they get body count from? The body keeps score. It's a body count.
Oh yeah.
No.
I'm sorry. I can't, because you know why? Cause I was in this other, I was in this other. I know. Comic mode.
We were in different con.
We were in different compartments. I don't even think we compartmentalize that much, but it's funny to like at or
because us or humans.
I think us.
We don't compartmentalize.
I don't know. Do we?
We're
do
just
we
like a buffet that off? You just spill in.
Excuse me.
All over.
Know. You know what?
The,
maybe
the carrots
maybe.
Are with the cucumbers.
Oh. Like a different buffet.
That's yeah, just going wild.
It's going bananas.
That reminds me.
But I feel like since I am in this other reality zone again, I do really commend our guest, though, for having the courage to speak up and make her film. And it's very, very important. It is going to make a difference, you know.
And apparently... In her class, in the classical music world, she's known. Like yeah. She's a known person. And it's which you need. You need the people who are known to speak up, right? Yeah. They gotta speak up. And so it's a big it shouldn't be brave, but it is, right? Like it should be like it's brave of her to. Because you worry that it's risking your career, right? By speaking up, because you're going to disruptors are going to potentially some people you run the risk of, at least in your head, I think, which is right. Why people don't speak up.
Right.
That I'm going to lose work or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so it's brave that you're taking the chance that people will instead go, you're right. Let's crush this.
Just to be vulnerable too, to share your story, because it wasn't, you know, like. You know, what was it, 10 years ago or how long ago was it? I don't remember people just openly saying that they were abused.
Yeah.
Like,
no,
you know.
And like, I wonder if Me Too hadn't happened, if they would have been able to keep this would have been able to come out.
Yeah.
Like, it's hard to know.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the things I don't like in our modern society is I just heard something in my, something just shut down around me. I just heard a computer shut down and I was panicked that I was about to lose you. And I'm like, I don't know what device here just shut down, but something did.
We won't lose each other. We're like such good friends.
No.
This one, we're 100. I'm just saying that. Can we please, let's still.
What?
Let's still podcast when we're 100, Silas.
Yes.
You will be older than 100 if I'm 100, but we'll still do it. We'll go on to the gym.
Thank you. Thank you for pointing that out.
Yes. I'm also being healthy. And
thank you for pointing out, as I'm looking at my wrinkle, you know what? My CPAP, I feel like my CPAP mask is now like affecting my face. It's giving me wrinkle lines that I didn't have before. I got to hydrate better. Or I'm going to have to hold my face like this while we podcast.
You can do that.
Pull.
Make some custom headphones, you know?
That pull my face back.
Well,
that,
you know what? Let me get you a wig. I can move on right so, and we'll just pull it back. I don't know how to do
it. What's that called? A facelift? Is that a facelift?
Sure. Yeah.
That's what white people do, right? Facelifts?
Some of them, yeah.
Yeah.
You know what's funny, Silas? It's
doing stuff to my eyes. But like, yeah, I need headphones that also give a facelift.
I don't know, because you said white people, it just made me think of, I don't think anybody from my work listens to this, but if they do, hi.
Speaking of white people?
Yeah, exactly. I will so often be at the meeting and be like, I'm the only brown one here, whatever. But I don't say that. I just think it sometimes. But it's funny because like one of them, and she's so sweet. She thinks I'm so much younger than I am. It's so obvious. Oh, yeah. And I just think it's sweet. Actually, I think I said, well, the first time she said it, I was like, oh, I'm not that young. And she was like, oh, yes, you are. And I was like, okay, well, thank you. She has no idea. And I have tried to correct her that much. But part of me wonders if I try harder so people would maybe take me a little more seriously if they thought I was older. And the other part of me is like, let's just feel young.
Do they think you're 20?
12. No, I have no idea how old they think I am. It's just, she referred to me as a pretty young thing. And then she apologized because she's like, oh, I didn't mean to objectify you by saying that. I'm like, no, it's okay. Cause she was respectful about it. She was just sweet. And I was like, no, it was nice to hear somebody say that about me. I haven't heard that in a while. I'm not that young.
Yeah. I go back and forth now about being annoyed if someone implies a youthfulness, it's something that's going to be irritating to me, to that you're creating a friction point for me to just purchase something or whatever, obviously unnecessarily.
Alcohol.
Or being like, oh gosh, yeah, well, sure, I could pass for that. And then I'm like, now I feel like you're just mocking me, thinking that I don't look old. Like I have to shave every day to hide the gray. That's it. We've gone on and on, even with our cutout section. But hey, I was glad to get a guest in today. Glad we could do that. Everyone go check out that movie. Premieres next week in Santa Barbara.
Yes.
Well, this week, because if you're listening, it's this week. It's actually today. So go to Santa Barbara.
Go to Santa Barbara.
Black and a half.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to the longest running comedy podcast in Seattle, probably. Yes, this is Black and a Half, hosted by Silas Lindenstein and Samantha Rund. Black and a Half.